chen al derech zeh. And similarly is the word selem, ki hem adomim b'mashmon b'tzad ma. There are similar words to selem in the moon. So in chapter 1 he has told you the word selem does not mean any kind of physical image or likeness, but rather it is some kind of imagery that is used to define the nature of a being and finding similarities in construct and concept. Okay, that's what the word selem means. God is no physical picture of God, but there are things we can say about God, about the nature of God, the way a human being understands it. We can say certain things about God, and that is where there is a likeness of man to God. Okay, that's what chapter 1 is telling us. Now, if you look in the Rambam himself, the Rambam gives you his interpretation. Now, I want to spend a few minutes, since this is an extremely important concept, Selem Elohim, before we get to Reb Chaim's answer in the second chapter. I want to give you some other very famous answers so you get a wholesome balance of what it means when we talk about the image of God.
So the essence of our soul is the essence of God.
We're jumping over here, but it's part of it.
We'll get to that.
So that's we've got a long way to go. That's already chapter 5, 6, and 7.
Okay.
It's going to get into there. I mean, you kind of have some idea, but we got to slowly get it piece by piece to see what they're actually saying. But it's going to play a role. It's going to fit in. Okay, so let me give you a few other explanations of what it means, the image of God. Some you may understand, some you may not. It's okay. Doesn't matter. Reb Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the Italian author who died right before Reb Chaim of Volozhin was born. He authored many great works, the Das Tfunos, I don't know how they say it in English. Feldheim's got all the books in English translated. I think that's the Knowing Heart. The Knowing Heart wrote other great works, the Mesillas Yeshorim, Path of Just. Great work, great writer, great mystic. So Luzzatto says like this, and the truth is Reb Chaim Volozhin himself later on will talk a little bit about it. Luzzatto goes to town on it. He'll mention a little bit about it as well. He says like this, what do we mean by the image of man is created in the image of God? He says like this, the structure of the human being, the way you and I are constructed, the structure of the human being is the end result and is also a mirror of God's conduct in this world. In other words, God has certain conducts that he operates within this world. How do we have any reflection of that conduct? It is part of the human body. The human body, if you understood well how a human body works, this would give you an indication of how God acts within this world.
Yeah.
Why? You asking why?
Yeah.
Why? Because God wants to make it easier for you to know
what
he's doing.
Human body. I mean, the physical?
Yeah, your physical body is great symbolism within that body of yours that reflects conducts of God. Okay? All the body parts are symbolic of different conducts of God. And also in the physical realm, to the end result of those conducts. In other words, the way you want a mirror of God's conduct, you'll find it in your body. And also the way your body is an end result of his conduct. To put it very simply, overly simply, you have an eye. The eye is able to discern. It's able to scan. It's able to observe. God conducts the world through, for what we can understand, how he observes what's happening in the world. Okay? The way different parts of the body, there's a right half of the body which is more powerful. There's a left side that is weaker. There's more powerful attributes of God and how he deals with the world, and then there's quote-unquote weaker attributes how he deals with the world. There are, if we knew to the depths, which could be, you know, Luzzatto talks about this, to realize that the way our body operates is in a micro way, of how God deals with us in this world. And later on, Reb Chaim will do a beautiful treatise on the whole system of how we eat. And how we ate is reflective very much of God's conduct in this world. and almost, so to speak, just the way we eat, so to speak, God needs to eat off of this world. Now, it's a very wild concept, but when you go through it, it's beautiful, and it becomes so simplistic. When you just think about what is involved in the digestive system, so to speak, God has to digest our activities. And he'll talk about it. But so for now, just to realize that God decided that he wanted to have certain conducts and attributes operating in this world, and therefore the form of the human being has such a form to reflect that conduct, and because there is such a conduct, the human being works in such a way as well. Okay? You don't understand it. It's kind of vague, but that's fine for now. But the idea I want you to understand is that the idea of image, man was created in God's image. There's physical imagery. My hand. God has a conduct of a hand in this world. There's a conduct in this world of a hand, of a foot, of an eye, of an ear, of a mind. Okay, there's such a conduct in how he deals with this world. So we should realize that we reflect in our life that there is such a conduct.
Okay. Also, where we tie in kashrut, and we are what we eat, taking.
Okay, that's going to fit in. That's going to fit into that. Because, partially. I mean, all mitzvah observance will fit into it, but that's part of it. That's part of it. Yeah. Yeah, attributes and how he relates with this world. Because truly, God has no attributes. And Rav Chaim's going to discuss this in the beginning of the second gate. You can't define God. If you could, he wouldn't be God. Right? However, we play this manipulative game to give us some kind of understanding. How we only can understand God by how he impacts on us. And how he impacts on us, we, by our human impact that we receive, come up with definitions of his conduct, which are totally not a definition of him. Okay, this is a heavy idea. He talks about a lot in the second gate. Okay, in other words, God acts, God has no attributes. What's an attribute? Human definition. God cannot be defined by human terms. It's impossible. It's impossible for human beings to define God with their terms. God created you, so there's no way you can define God. It's like asking a clock to define the clockmaker. Not possible. It's not possible for a clock to define the clockmaker. Human being cannot define God who created him. It's just not possible. God transcends anything that's physical. And our whole realm of definition is based on physicality. God transcends physicality. Whatever we say about God, you know for sure is not true. About God's essence. But since God interfaces with a physical world, and therefore we as physical human beings feel the effects of the interface, so the effect that we feel has a human condition quality that we sense, and that's about as much of God we can understand. And that conduct of God is reflected in the human body. That's Halutzado, and Rav Chaim's going to discuss that as well. I'm just telling it to you now. If you don't understand it, that's great. But he's going to get to it a lot more later on. You might be able to define it, though. I mean, I'm not a physicist, but physicists may be able to define it even. You can't touch it, but it could still be there. You can manipulate it.
You can measure it.
You can manipulate gravity. You could create a scenario to take the gravity out of gravity. Right? So now you can do something to it. And I'm sure if you get into the atomic structure that's going on there, that's something that's happening there. No?
Yeah. There's some holes of that.
And you can directly get involved with that pole. Construct things so you can get a greater handle on gravity than on God. It could very well be, you know, the simplest way is how a parent deals with a child. Right? A healthy parent deals with a child not necessarily to what the parent is really essentially in terms of a being. A lot of times parents act out certain activities towards the child which are not really who they are. Right? Sometimes a parent pretends that they're angry. But he's not really angry. He wants the child to know he's upset with him. The parent's not even upset with him, but wants the child to learn. And how's the child going to learn if the parent projects a feeling of upsetness towards the child? Doesn't mean the parent is upset at all. Pretending, so to speak. So the kid thinks, boy, daddy's angry at me. Daddy's not angry with you. He's just showing a behavior that seems to indicate a behavior of being upset. But he's not upset. Follow what I'm saying? So that would maybe be a better parable. God goes and destroys a city. Boy, he must have been upset. Boy, that's the power of justice there, man. Right? Although, you can't use that in terms of definitions of God. It just doesn't exist. You can't use any of these definitions. Okay, let's go on. Now, Rav Dessler, there's a second definition, which I think is just great. Just a great definition of the image of God. It says like this. What do we know about God? There are certain things we do know about God. We could be sure of them about God. What's one of them? When God created the world, he created the world why? For our pleasure. Because he has a great desire to give. God is a giver. That we know. He gave everything. He gave world. He gave life. He gave sustenance. He's a tremendous giver. And therefore, God cannot give unless there are those who can receive the good. Created people. That's why the Torah says, Olam Chesed Yibonah, the world was built on kindness. So when we say a human being is created in the image of God, it means that God put in within the human being this spiritual need of having to give to another individual. Every human being, the definition of a human being is a being that needs to provide or give to another person. And that characteristic is the definition of the Tzelem Elokim, the image of God that's within the human being. Okay? God's clear behavior of God is he's a giver. That's clear. Okay? And therefore, a human being, by definition, being in the image of God, is a giver. That is the godly quality that resides within a human being. That is his image of God. Okay, this just goes on with Lutzado, but kind of narrows it down to one very specific area over here. So, for example, the generation of the flood, okay, they did all kinds of sins. And the Zohar writes that the sins of that generation destroyed their Tzelem Elokim, destroyed their godly image. And the Zohar says that God did not destroy mankind until mankind first destroyed their godly image. Right? Only after man's Tzelem was destroyed could destruction in a physical way come into the world. That's what the Zohar says. Now why does the Zohar talk about their Tzelem being destroyed? Why is he getting into the whole concept? Because what was the main sin of the generation of the flood? What was their main sin? They were takers and they weren't givers. Stealing, theft, taking things for themselves. They were not givers. By definition, that is the biggest destruction of one's godly image. Because the most central point of what makes a human being human is the godly image of being a giver. For example, the generation of the flood, the husband and wife were intimate in ways in which they could not have children. Okay. Now, purposely. So this is referred to in the literature as that act of birth control was referred to as shvichas damim, murder. That's how the writings call this. So it's very hard to understand why is birth control considered murder. Okay, we're not talking about abortion, we're talking about birth control. Okay, so you could say, will be a simple answer. Simple answer to that question. Okay, you're ruining the possibility of life. So it's an advanced form of murder. It's a preemptive form of murder. If you don't allow life to come, well, I guess I could call it murder. That's a simple meaning. But on a deeper level, it's much more profound. He says, when one practices birth control and one is guilty of murder, what is one really murdering? He is murdering his image of God. He's murdered his Tzelem Elokim. His image of God is being a giver. What is it? A person does not want to assume the responsibility of providing and giving for another, bringing another life in this world. Okay, I can relate to this pretty much over the last 24 hours. Okay? Okay, why does a person not want to have children? One reason. Selfish. Having a child is a tremendous burden that you have to constantly supply and constantly give. I mean, may he live for 120 years. My little baby boy came out, and the first moment he was hungry. The very first moment, he was like grunting and kvetching, and they couldn't understand. They were suctioning him, and they were giving him air, and this and that. My wife says, let me nurse him. And once he got on, he didn't want to get off. He was hungry. He was hungry. Okay? And that's what it was. He had what he ate, and it was fine. He went to sleep. And that's it. You've got now a constant entity out there that needs you to give non-stop. That's what a child is. Okay? Now, a person practicing birth control for those reasons, very focused for this reason, is basically saying, I'm not interested in giving. Okay? Just focusing very narrowly over here. So what is a person really doing? He's destroying his Tzelem Elokim. What is your image of God? It's to be a giver. So you're saying, I don't want to give. So what have you destroyed? You haven't destroyed this little baby. You haven't even come to the batting plate. You haven't even, you've prevented it to start off. But you've killed yourself. You've killed the image of God that you have. Now, this doesn't mean to say that everyone who practices birth control is killing himself. Okay? Because there could very well be legitimate reasons why one could practice birth control. If, you know, you want to be able to give to each child to the best of your ability, and that would mean maybe spacing the children out a few years apart. Having seven children in 7 years may make you an ineffective giver, and therefore it doesn't stand to reason to do that. Okay? So therefore there'd be reasons why you could say that, you know what? Okay, you go to a rabbi, he could give him the issue, and he'll say, okay, I could see to suspend having to have children for a while. Okay, so that we're not saying people who practice birth control are murderers. Okay, but what the Rav Dessler's explained, the people of the generation of the flood, I mean, this was a philosophy of life. Okay, you have birth control, that's a philosophy of life, right? The oinks and dinks syndrome, right? Right, oinks and dinks. Dinks is double income. And oinks is one income. One income, no kids. Doinks. N-K-S. No kids. Oinks and things. That's a... Where are you guys? A rabbi has to tell you this?
I didn't know the oinks.
Dinks. Double income, no kids. Right? Oinks. One income, no kids. You never heard of it. Okay, good. So, you thought it was a mystical term, right? So, But that's like a philosophy. The philosophy is no kids. Right? That's what the rabbis are going after. I philosophically don't want to have kids. I want to have a good time in life. Children are a pain in the neck. I don't want to give. That person is destroying his Tzelem Elokim. Okay. And you know, it's hard to see how different, you know, how different side may not be than what it was before the generation of the flood. It's a very, no one will argue, we're a very narcissistic generation. The more narcissistic you are, the more you're destroying your Tzelem Elokim. No question about it. Now, there's another ramification of Tzelem Elokim. It's like this. It's an interesting phenomena. Wild animals. The Tarzan phenomena. A little baby can be dropped in the woods, and a roaring lion may more than that will not touch that baby, will not kill the baby. Animals generally were meant to have a fear of man, although man is much less physically strong than a tiger and a lion, and animals intrinsically should have a fear of man. Why? Because animals can sense the Tzelem Elohim that's in a human being. It's an instinct that God put into animals. Mm-hmm. Animals understand when they're in the presence of a more godly being than themselves. It's not because they have brains. It's instinct. It's instinct. That's the way it is. And therefore, when a person does things that takes away his Tzelem Elohim, then the animals no longer have fear over human beings. That's why Cain, after he killed Abel, was very afraid to go into the exile that God wanted to give him. He was afraid the animals would destroy him, because he sensed he had lost part of his image of God because of the murder he did of his brother. That's why you hear great stories of great rabbis. You know, Daniel is thrown into the lion's den. They don't eat him. Why not? Because he carries the godly image with him. He carries the godly image with him. It's not just a fluke. It's not a miracle. It's not a miracle. Don't ever look at it as a miracle. It's a reality of life. A holy person who carries the godly image, an animal will not touch the godly image. What?
When you're first born,
yeah.
The image that you have is perfect.
Yes and no. Yes and no.
Are we going uphill or downhill on this?
The truth is, to a certain degree, we're born as animals. We're born as animals. Left to ourselves, we become animals. We're born very selfish. We're born very selfish. We have to be trained to become givers. Man intrinsically would be selfish and destroy himself without Torah, without guidance. Maybe not even then if you don't study. If you don't study. But there's a concept of retaining this Tzelem Elohim, all right? So it's not just a nice lifestyle, but it's a real reality that can be sensed in creation over here. So these are the famous ideas of Tzelem Elohim. Reb Chaim is going to take this into much broader horizons now. Okay, so let's go on to the second chapter. We usually will not go past 10 o'clock. Okay? We'll not go past 10 o'clock. Chapter 2. So, we got Tzelem. Now, next part. Now, if you notice something very interesting. Whenever it talked about Tzelem, it said Tzelem Elohim. Mm-hmm. Now, what question may have struck you when you, every time it says Tzelem Elohim? How many names do you know that talk about God? You have the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey. We've got a lot of names of God. Why is it the name of God, that particularly Elohim, is associated with the concept of Tzelem Elohim? Man is in the image of Elohim as opposed to the image of Yud Hey Vav Hey. Okay?
Giving the good God.
That's the original.
That's the original?
The Elohim, wasn't it? That's the first attribute, and then the Yud Hey Vav Hey was introduced. You have to bring that kindness into the world.
Okay, Elohim has one meaning of justice. God originally created the world with justice. Gracious for Elohim. In the beginning, God created the world with ultimate justice. Saw the world could not sustain itself that way, and therefore added the Yud and the Hey and the Vav Hey, which is kindness. That's one definition.
But Elohim is the first concept of God in the Torah. The creation of everything.
That's just a technicality. Which is true, but doesn't answer the question. It's correct, but it doesn't answer the question. In other words, you got the right answer, but you haven't told me anything. You know, you're right. It's the first thing we're told about God in the Torah. That it's the first reference to God in the Torah. So how does that fit into man? Right? But all the other names of God, the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey, they refer to the God of kindness. It refers to the oneness of God. There's another name of God, Shin Dalad Yud. Shah with Dai. And that's referred to whenever God holds back some sort of resource. When God was creating the world, as it was unfolding to be more and more and more physical, God said, "Die, Le'olama, it's enough. The physicality of this world has reached its maximum. There can be no more physicality of this world, or I'll be totally out of the picture." Right? So that's another concept of God. There's a concept of Aleph Lamed, Ale, where it refers to God's justice again. Siva with Os. Is God as a warrior. All these great names of God, but the one name of God that's associated with the image of God which we hold is Tzelem Elohim. So Reb Chaim is now going to want to know what does Elohim mean? So he's going to tell us what that means now. So, chapter 2, page base. Amnam, however, Lahavin Inyan Amro B'Tzelem Elohim, to understand what it means when it says Tzelem Elohim, Daika, specifically that name, V'lo Shem Acher, and not another name. Why? Ki Shem Elohim Yadua Perusho. It's known what Elohim means. In other words, you dummies, everybody knows this, says Reb Chaim. He says, everybody knows what Elohim means. Like, I'm just going to tell you what everybody knows. It's a very humbling book. Shehu Moreh, Elohim teaches us, Shehu Yisbarach Shemo, that the Almighty Blessed is He, is Baal HaKochos Kulam, the master of all forces, the omnipotent, the one who possesses all powers. That's what Elohim means. Kemo Shemavuar, as it is explained in the part of the Shulchan Aruch called the Tur Orachaim, Simon Hay, chapter 5, he doesn't tell you what it says. I looked up the Tur, and the Tur says the following. The Tur says, Elohim means that he is a takif, powerful, Baal HaYecholos, one of infinite capabilities, Ubaal HaKochas Kulam, and the master of all forces and sources of energy in the world. That's what the word Elohim means. Okay? Now, he's going to explain that. What does that mean? He's the master of all forces. He's extremely powerful. There's no source of power other than him. How powerful is this source? So explain. The Inyan Mashahu Yisbarach Nikra Baal HaKochos, and this concept in which God is called the Baal HaKochos, the master of forces. He says like this. Kilo kimidas basar v'dam midas HaKadosh Baruch. The attributes of flesh and blood are not like the attributes of God. Let's look at the difference. Ki ha'adam, a person, kishabona binyan derech mashal me'etz, if he builds, constructs something, let's say, out of wood, ein ha'bona borer umamtzi az mikocha ha'etz, the builder does not create and bring into existence through his power the tree. He doesn't create the tree. What does he do? Rak shlokech etzim shekvar nivru. He takes trees that are already created, umesadrim babinyam, and he arranges them in making this construction. Va'achar shekvar sidrim l'fi ritzona, and when he finishes arranging it according to the way he willed it such, now im shekocho husar v'nistalik mehem, now that his power is removed from this building, but im kozeh habinyan kayom, but still the building stands. Human being, you're using your forces, using your power, you're drilling, you're screwing, you're thising and you're thatting. You're impacting this item with your force. Right? After all, you're finished, your force leaves, and the item continues to exist. The item exists independent of the builder anymore. The existence of this house doesn't need a builder anymore. Okay? Next paragraph. Avohu Yisbarach Shemo, but the Almighty, Kimo Be'es Briyas Ha'olamos Kulam, just like at the time when he created all the worlds. How did he create all the worlds? Bira'am V'himtziyam Hu Yisbarach Yesh Me'ayin. He created the world, Yesh, something, Me'ayin from nothing. Mm-hmm. Ex nihilo. Now he created it, B'kocho Ha'bilti Tachlis, with an unlimited force, with an unlimited power. And just like when he created the world, it was with an infinite amount of force to create. How the infinite could create something finite was with an unbelievable force. But that's not all. Kein me'yaz, so it is from that time on, kol yom v'chol rega mamash, every day and every moment, kol koach mitziyosam v'sidram v'kiyumam, all of their existence and the order of their establishment in this physical world, all of creation, every second, depends on one factor: how much the Almighty is feeding with His will the continued existence of these items in the world. Koach v'shivas or chodesh, the power and the new energy of the new light. In other words, all of creation's existence depends on God's continuous feed of spiritual energy into the world. Every moment it has to have God's maintenance for it to exist. If God would for one second not be feeding into these items, in one moment they would self-destruct and self-disintegrate. They would not exist. So what's he saying over here? He's saying there's a big difference between what man makes and what God creates. First of all, man does not create the resources, number one. And number two, when he finishes the thing he creates, so to speak, the creation can now exist independently from the builder. Anything that man comes to deal with already had an independent existence and will continue to have an independent existence outside of the builder. Okay?
If Adam had not sinned, would he not have lived forever?
He would have lived forever.
Does that imply some sort of independence?
No. Good question. You think if something lives forever, it's independent. But it doesn't. It doesn't. It just means God will forever sustain it. God will forever sustain it. That's all. That's all it means. Right? So now when God is the Baal HaKochos, you want to know how powerful he is? That God's will is constantly feeding into the world those things that have to go in the world to have it exist. In other words, before the world came into existence, was there anything there? What made it exist? Okay, the only thing was God's will. God's will put it into existence.
Okay.
That spiritual energy put it into existence. Okay? Now, what he's saying more than this is that there is a Baal Kochos, the master of forces that exists to keep all of existence continually existing. In other words, this is an existence that unless God doesn't constantly throw the same force at it that he's used to create it, it would cease to exist, which is an unbelievable amount of force that's being applied at every second in every realm of every aspect of all of its creation that's over there.
So that's just an axiom, isn't it? I mean, it's just a pure unprovable tenet.
We can explain it to you, and the Torah says it so. Let's go back. Can you prove that the world was created? Maybe.
Yeah, probably.
Maybe. But the Torah says the world was created.
That's
your biggest proof.
You could independently come out with a rationale for it, that there's no other explanation. But in terms of independent existence, and this concept that he's bringing down, that Hashem has to continue, or Elohim has to continuously put energy in.
Okay, well, we can explain part of it. We can explain part of it. Maybe we'd want to ask a different question. Okay, but this idea that he is talking about now, this is one of the most fundamental principles in Jewish mysticism. This concept, the concept of God constantly renewing creation moment by moment, is like the cornerstone of mystical learning that he's telling it. He's starting very early in the book to get this idea across. Yeah?
I have a question all the time. I mean, was nothing there before, and suddenly we have God creating the world. Why at this specific moment? Why not before? Why not after?
So, Fred, what's the answer?
We weren't there. You know, we weren't there when
we
created.
Those are questions we don't have the answers to.
We don't get the answers.
There's certain questions that you will not have the answers. Human being cannot know the answer to that. Certain things we're not going to know the answer to, and that's one of them.
Then the Zohar doesn't talk anything about it. Why is that? I mean, it's certainly time. It's limited.
Ask a better question. Why did God create the world, period?
Right. That's the same type of question.
Okay, but there's no answer. Human being cannot know that answer. Okay, fine.
You started to talk about it. I don't want to give away the show. It's what we're going to be talking about.
But everything we're going to talk about, why did God want to do it that way? Whatever we're going to talk about, why did God want... God couldn't get along without doing that?
Of course.
What compelled God to want to run it that way? Does God need to do that?
I guess he
does. If God needs something, he isn't God. A God cannot have needs. By definition, a God who has needs lacks perfection. Okay?
Find it.
The need was not the need within God, but the desire for us to give, to sell,
why does
for
God,
us to grow.
Why did God create a situation like that?
I think so that there could be a flow of his energy.
Why did his energy have to flow? Couldn't he get along without it flowing?
I guess because it gives him pleasure.
God needs pleasure? Okay, then he's back to being a physical being.
Not in a physical.
Oh, I don't know what that means.
Then why needed the pleasure?
Again, a God has no needs. A God has no needs. God has no needs.
That's the purity of the kindness.
Right? So then he could have got... He'd be fine and dandy without a world. He'd be fine and dandy without a world. Well, a perfect God has no needs, so therefore he can get along independently of anything else. Got along good enough without this. For infinity before he got along without it. Why do you have to bother
now? Why suddenly
that? Something a human being cannot know the answer to that question.
I think it's important to take sort of a materialistic approach towards your answer that question. In other words, you're saying, well, if you can't explain it, well, then let's reverse materialism. Materialism can't explain it either.
We only can know how much God told us to know. And what did he tell us to know? From what the Torah tells us, from the beginning of creation. Now that you're here, I'm telling you how to play the game. You want to know what was before? Don't bother figuring that out.
We are therefore a partial representation, but not a complete representation. Because we do have needs and wants. Therefore,
certainly.
It can't be a perfect replication of God.
Correct.
But it's not perfect anyhow. We had so many people that they were not perfect. And
correct.
Why didn't God create some perfection? I mean, he's perfect.
Correct.
I think the perfection that you're implying is static, non-growing perfection. If God
does need, God need to grow?
If there was no need, and there is nothing in the past. Because there is a need, I don't think
who's
automatically
need?
Makes God imperfect or less than perfect.
Well, you'd have to be able to explain why, and that would be pretty hard.
Can't do that
right now. Be pretty hard. And still to know why he needed that. You know, the ultimate God, God has no needs, does not have to grow, and does not eat any of that. It's just, this is like, this is beyond. And you know what? Discussion of this will not bear any fruits either. Will not bear any fruits.
Okay. And we won't talk about
you have to understand where you're at, what you can accomplish, and what you can accomplish with that, all right? But this is a very critical point, that God is constantly renewing creation every moment. The constant renewal of creation. Now, you might ask, doesn't this take away from God's creative abilities? In other words, if a human being makes a table, he can walk away from it. And it's fine. God seems to have to keep hanging around there. God, can't you make the world and let it run by itself? In other words, we're better than God. I can make a table and I can go to sleep tonight. And I don't have to think about it. The table will stay. God creates the world, he can't go to sleep, so to speak. He's got to keep pushing. Come on, let's get the flow in there. You know, like, you know, you got an air conditioner, and as long as it's plugged in, the energy's coming in all the time. As soon as the plug, someone steps on a plug, boom, the air conditioner's off. God's got to keep pushing it and pushing it. Why does God have to keep doing that?
We can't survive without that.
No, so that there's an answer to this. I'm saying from a technical, you want to know some of the technicals. Technicals is there. The difference between man and God is like this. Man created something from something.
Right.
So therefore, the something that was there was independent before the builder came to it. And its potential to be transformed into something else existed there before the builder came as well. And therefore, those items were there, independent of the builder. The potential to change was there before the builder came. So the builder came in and went in and used the potential that was there. And now, that which was there before the builder came is still there. Okay, on the other hand, God created something from nothing. If there was nothing there, there was totally zero potential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now God made all that. The whole existence is totally dependent on God. It's totally dependent. There's no nature. Nothing has no nature. There's no predisposition. It's just the parable that you can give is to a rock. A rock, you throw it up against gravity. How long is it going to go up against gravity? To the extent of that the force keeps pushing it up there. Why? Because a rock does not have by nature, any nature, to move upwards against gravity. So you need constant flow of the power of the force to keep it going, because it doesn't have it in itself at all to sustain. And as soon as the power is gone, it ceases to act as a rock that moves forward ahead. The world had no potential. Intrinsically, nothing had no potential. God put in with it that force. And as soon as God would withdraw that force, then it wouldn't exist again. That's the logic to that. That's why, because it's the greatness of God, necessitates the constant, continuous maintenance of it. And that reflects the total dependence the world has on God. It could not exist without God initiating it.
Then how do we?
It had no second nature to begin with for you to just move around. You've got your piece of metal. It's there with you or without you. It's got a potential to be made into it, so a candelabra with you or without you. It can exist with you or without you. With it, and its potential is there without you. The world had no potential. And therefore it needs the constant feed. Because as soon as that potential is gone, as soon as the feed is gone, there's nothing there.
In other words, it doesn't answer that question.
Okay, so now you take this question a step further. Okay, then that's the next question. So why did he do it that way? If he's that smart enough already. Okay, so again, Peter, to your point, it still doesn't prove it. What I told you didn't prove anything. It just gives you some of the mechanism of it.
Well, as I said,
the Torah says so. And he's going to give you the source in a minute. The Torah says so. This is the reality of how the existence
came to be.
It's a tenet
of belief.
Yeah. That's going to be the rest of the book. Why is it that it has to constantly be nourished and fed? We'll see. We'll see why it has to be that way. There's a logic, there's a wisdom to that. Okay. However, what do you see? God is unbelievably powerful. The entire world, this table, has the will of God nurturing it every second. As a plug plugged into it. And if the plug would stop for 1 second, the table would cease to exist. Okay? Try to figure how powerful you'd be if a whole company depends on your brain power. If you'd leave the company would collapse, right? You're involved in this department, that department, this department, and you're all over the place. And you keep the company going with your input, right? As soon as you'd leave, the company would collapse. Right? Every single thing in this world needs God's constant feed and input.
But if God has to participate in all creation and new creation, and everything that comes from something, why is man able to destroy, to murder, to kill, to end a life?
Why is that? So that's part of the game that God's playing here. This is part of the game of free choice that he allows to happen. Why can somebody do something bad to what God created?
Right.
God is creating your hand, constantly creating your hand to kill somebody. And he's allowing that to happen. This is part of the scenario how he wants life to be played out, which we will see is a very important factor. Free will play a very important role. If you can't destroy anything, then there is no free will. Okay? That's part of... You'd have no principle of free will. You want to kill somebody, you shoot, nothing happens. If you live forever, what would happen? That's what happened. First man should have lived forever till he corrupted himself. A corrupted person could learn forever, could live forever. It's a dangerous individual. If you knew you could live forever and you were bad, you'd really be bad. That's why God had to throw him out. You have to realize, you know, man, for you to eventually have some kind of responsibility in life, you got to realize you don't live forever. Didn't have to be that way, but that's how it ended up. And it is true. God shows a tremendous amount of restraint in allowing man to use the talents that God gives him at the very same time to destroy part of his God's creation, so to speak, to go against the will of God. And we're going to talk about that in the Rabbeinu Yonah class. We'll talk about tshuva. He says that is like the ultimate rebellion against God. He gives a parable of a king. A king takes this forlorn guy who can't walk. He picks him up on his shoulder to take him around to get a visit of the palace. And while he's carrying him on his shoulder, the guy takes a gun and is shooting the king's best friends. Okay? You know, he says that's exactly what happens when a person sins in this world. You are taking the... You can't do anything unless God would sustain your life every second. And he's sustaining, and with that sustaining ability, you're going and doing against the will of God. A tremendous amount of restraint that God has, so to speak, to let you do that. Why does he let you do that? Because we've got to play the game of free will. We'll see how important that figures into the game over here.
But again, you're using human attributes to describe God, and I don't think you can do that.
You can't, but you have to. Because you can't live otherwise. You can't
but
live otherwise.
But to say
otherwise.
That God has restraint is therefore saying God is in our image.
Again, from our perspective, it looks like a heck of a lot of restraint. Again, it's unfortunate Reb Chaim doesn't discuss this till the second gate. It goes at length to describe, for now, until you get to the second gate, you just have to accept when we use these human terms for God. You just got to accept it for now. He's going to explain why we have to live with that reality. But that's a problem. It's a good question. He doesn't address it till the next gate. So we're just going to leave it at that point. But it's the only way we can understand how God is involved in this world. He is involved this way. And it looks like a lot of restraint. It does look like a lot of restraint, doesn't it? From your point of view, does it look like restraint?
Yes.
Do you live with those perceptions?
But it's contrary to what we said before, because now we're saying that God is in our image, in terms that we understand, as opposed to us being in His, or whatever portion of it
is. No, we are in His image. We are in His image, and therefore we should show restraint.
Yeah.
Therefore, we should show restraint.
Yes.
What's that image? The image that we can understand of what God is. Okay, it's going back to Reb Teskla and Lutzado. Reb Chaim is saying, God is the ultimate force. The